Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. With people living longer than ever before, retirement can seem out of reach, right? But instead of waiting until you're 65, one approach is the idea of having mini retirements, maybe even multiple mini retirements before you retire for good. Will Rainey is the founder of Blue Tree Savings, a platform aimed at helping parents teach their kids about money. And he's going to talk about how this approach works. Spoiler alert, he's on a mini retirement in Hoi An, Vietnam. And asking for a raise, just the idea might give you the sweats. But as tough as it might be, it can be a critical conversation to ensure you are paid what you are worth. Manisha Thakur from Money Zen will be here with some tips. Then, how can you develop good financial habits? It definitely takes time, it takes intention, it takes practice. Connor Richardson is CPA, author of Millennial Money Makeover, and he's here to talk about how you can rewire your brain for financial success. Making these habits sticks, tough for anyone, very tough for young people in these times, given what's going on in the economy and the real estate market and the job market and all that. Dr. Moira Summers is a clinical neuropsychologist specializing in financial psychology, and she's here to share her tips for saving and budgeting for young Canadians. Plus, I'll speak with registered nurse Cassandra Mello about her passion for personal finance and why she decided to share her money tips on TikTok. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and by Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Let's get started. With people living longer and longer and longer, our idea of retirement is changing. Some people are working longer, some people are working shorter, some people are working part-time. One way, one approach that we haven't talked about before is taking mini retirements. And I think this is a genius idea. Will Rainey is the founder of Blue Tree Savings, which is a platform aimed at helping parents teach their kids about money. And he joins us now from Hoi An, Vietnam. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce. Well, thank you for having me on the show.
It is our pleasure. Are you in Vietnam just so this interview would have credibility? Is that, and then you're like flying back to some boring place like Manchester, England afterwards? Is that how this goes?
No, I'm actually been here for 3 years now, and it's an amazing place. If people haven't been to Vietnam, and especially Hoi An, I strongly recommend it. It's a beautiful, beautiful place.
I have been, and that is why I am oozing jealousy, because it is spectacular. The food is extraordinary, and the people are lovely. So I am fully, we could talk about Hoi An the entire time, but we're not going to do that. We're going to talk about mini retirements or mini retirement. Is this like, how would you define it? Is this like a gap year for grownups?
Yeah, pretty much. It's to take time off work and do something a bit different. And if you've got, like me, I've got two young children, spend that little bit of quality time with them whilst they're young and kind of see them growing up. So yeah, no, it is a bit like a gap year.
Now, with a gap year, your responsibilities are low. You work in a bar for a while, you travel, maybe you work in a bar while you're traveling. How do grownups think about this? What's the framework? What's the way to make this happen if you aren't a trust fund baby?
So the key piece is a bit like retirement for good. You have to start early. And that's exactly what we did. We didn't just say on a whim, let's just leave our corporate jobs and start going living in Vietnam. It was put in place sort of pretty much about 10 years ago. We were always saying, right, we're savers. At some point, we want to use that money and save for peace. We don't want to just wait until we're old and we might have the time then, but we won't have our health. Let's do something when we're younger. So we kind of put in a bit of a plan to say, right, we're going to, in 10 years time, we'll do something different. And that's exactly what we did. And it's been the most amazing time spending this time with our daughters. And I've been able to do something completely different with my time. I've been, say, teaching kids about money and writing a book. So it's just given us a totally different view of the world. But you have to put a place in plan. It's not just a
whim. Do you predict you will go back to a traditional jobby jobberson job?
Yes, I do. But then I don't think I'll be thinking I'll be in that job until I'm 65. I think I'll be thinking of in maybe 10 years, another 10 years time, maybe retiring for good at that time, or doing another mini retirement. I think it's just so refreshing, and I've really enjoyed it and strongly recommend everyone think about doing it. But again, it's not going to be tomorrow. It's going to be in, say, a period of time.
In some fields, it is easier, both from a career standpoint and a financial standpoint, because teachers, for example, in Canada, they could do what's called a 4-over-5 plan. So you work for 4 years, you get the fifth one off, but you're paid the entire time, admittedly a reduced salary, but you're paid. In other areas, you come back after being gone for a year and the world has changed and there was no mechanism to save for that. So let's deal with that in two parts. First, the career element. What are you going to put on your LinkedIn when you go back into job search mode?
So I think it's going to be a case of what you've been doing in that period. And saying even the term sabbatical, I don't know, we use that in the UK for taking time off. And I think that's exactly what it is. But when you're talking to employers, etc., it makes you actually interesting. It totally does. It makes you've got a story to tell and people understand why you're doing it. You know, it's not a case of I just want to sit there and twiddle my thumbs and watch Netflix series for 2 years. Most people who I've met who have done something similar have all had interesting stories or done something with their time and got something to share and have learned new skills, met new people. And then when they do start work, they're completely refreshed. They're like ready to go. They've had that time off, raring to go.
So you say start early, and you had some runway there. Did you have a separate bank account? Did you budget for this? Give us, in a as granular as you can be, what did that plan actually look like?
So I bought a house, an apartment in sort of 2010. So we had been saving up for that, for our first house. And so we had already in that kind of savings mode already. And that was for our down payment on the house. And then we had our mortgage thereafter, but we were still earning more and getting more bonuses, et cetera. And so we thought, well, instead of just increasing our kind of lifestyle, let's just put that extra money away for savings for this kind of long-term plan. We allowed a little bit of lifestyle creep. So we had nicer holidays and went to nicer restaurants, et cetera, but we made sure that we always kept a little bit more of our bonuses and pay rises towards our investment. So I've always invested just in simple global index funds. And so that money went into those index funds. So they not only we put money away, but it's that money's been growing as well over that period of time.
What about a period of market correction? So how would that have gone if the markets had done in 2008 while you were in savings mode?
Yeah, no, so that would have been fine as well, because we're essentially living off the sort of some of the income from our savings. So we're still getting the dividends, and we rented out our apartment or our house actually in the UK. So we're getting those income. So it's more about the income than the capital value. We haven't really been buying and selling stocks and shares or apartments. We've been kind of living off the income from that. Now that might change for other people. We've been fortunate in terms of the amount of income that we're getting, and others might have to sell down a little bit. But as long as it's not, okay, I'm going to have to sell all of my life savings. Most of the time, it's about focusing on putting that money away to generate an income and trying to live off as much of that as possible.
You and this topic would be a magnet in many social environments. People are like, oh my God, why don't you do this? How to do this? As you listen to their questions and as people talk about, you know, what they value and how they roll and their saving habits and all those sorts of things, what would you identify as key elements of a human's temperament that would have this work? Because for some people, it's like, oh yeah, I could totally do that. And other people, you think, this is a terrible idea. You should just keep your job and retire the good old fashioned way, because this would not be a good fit for you.
Yeah, so it's all about patience for me. It's all about having... So I was very fortunate. My parents, I grew up in, my parents stayed in the same house for like 20, 25 years. And pretty much as soon as I finished university, college, they retired to Spain. So they retired early rather than did these mini retirements. But I got to see the benefits of that. So I'd be working really hard in my job, and I'd phone them up and say, what have you done today? And they're like, well, we're in the sun. We went to this nice little village. We painted a chair, read our books. And I was like, I want that. And so it gave me that kind of mindset of I had a goal and I had to be patient. I knew I wasn't going to be able to do that straight away. And so it's having that. I sacrificed having nice like designer clothes, etc. And I kind of very much didn't mind my friends and peers spending and having nicer things than me. because I had this goal. And because I've seen my parents benefit from that, I wanted to see that. So I was lucky from that point of view. But yeah, very much controlled that spending and had that kind of very determined mindset. I've got the savings, I'm going to have to give them a purpose. I'm not just going to sit
there. What do you think you're going to need to do to ease your re-entry into the working world? Because I can imagine if this were me, I'd be like, what was I thinking? Who is this email from? I'm not responding to this. I'm not doing a performance management process. No.
Yeah. To be honest, that is going to be a challenge, and it's going to be, but I'm kind of looking forward to, again, I've enjoyed the time with my family, but I quite liked it. I never hated my job. I enjoyed my job. When I had it in the past, it was never a push factor, it was a pull factor. So I'm looking forward to the challenge of accomplishing something new within the corporate piece, having teammates and working with people again on a regular basis. But also I have that longer term goal that I know that I'm not going to be doing it forever. Mm. I probably won't be doing it as long as other people, and I'm going to have that different mission. And yeah, I've got a nice sense of fulfillment, a lot of ease.
Did you, that is delightful to hear. And notice how I have no ease. So I'm like immediately barreling in and asking, what's my next question? Have you kept yourself in the mix? I don't know what type of work you do, but many, many types of work require sort of ongoing learning and knowing what's in the zeitgeist. Have you endeavored to keep one foot in, or have you said, no, both of those feet are in Vietnam and eating the delicious food here, and I'll just figure out what I've missed when I return?
Yeah, so I have been keeping up because my background is I was in investment. So I was advising some of the world's largest institutions about where to put their money. So what I've been doing since I've been in Vietnam is, say, focusing on helping parents teach their kids about money. And some of that is using those same skills. And I've kept my network because I've written a book. And so using my network and keeping in contact with them and talking to people. So I kind of kept in the loop with that and done a little bit of ad hoc consultancy with my old firm when they kind of needed sort of my expertise on odd ad hoc projects every now and then.
You've said your kids are young. At a certain point, you are going to say, Papa's going back to work. How do you think that will go for them? Have you been planting the seed that the life they're living is a period of time versus all the time?
Yeah, no, we have. As soon as we said we were leaving Hong Kong to come to Vietnam and what we're doing, we said it was a limited time. But we also tried to make it as a really good example for them. So we're saying that the reason that mommy and daddy can spend all this time with you is because we've been sort of planting our seeds, because we use that kind of analogy. And we've got this kind of financial forest and we've got these seeds growing. And so therefore, if you want to have that time with your kids when you're older, you need to start saving now. But yeah, I think they're going to miss it. But I'm hoping now that we're in the world of working from home, and my next role will be largely based at home, that I can still spend that sort of morning time and come with the routines and traditions that we've got. Because clearly my kids are at school, so that sort of time, weekend time and morning and evening time should hopefully still be there.
Will, this has been an extraordinarily inspiring conversation. I have got to say that the only time I was in Hoi An, Vietnam was with my then 6-year-old. So we took our 6-year-old on a tour through Thailand and Vietnam, and we had an extraordinary experience in Ho Chi Minh City and Halong Bay and all those places, but it was limited to 3 weeks, which is barely a blip compared to what you've got. I appreciate you taking the time. I know it is very, very late where you are. You may now go to bed.
It was a pleasure talking to you, Bruce. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Will. Will Rainey, the founder of Blue Tree Savings, which is a platform to help parents teach their kids about money. He was here to talk to us about a concept called mini retirements. Don't just save for one that happens when you're in your 60s. Save for multiple that you can experience over the course of your life.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
When it comes to your money and your career, negotiating can get you pretty far.
but that doesn't mean it's easy. Asking for a raise can be a daunting task, but knowing your worth and knowing exactly how to ask for a raise is half the battle. Here to tell us more is Manisha Thakur. She is the Vice President of Financial Education at Brighton Jones in Seattle. She joins us from sunny Portland, Oregon. Hello there.
Bruce.
Hello. I know our listeners are like, what's up with them? It's because we're friends. We're like, hey, why is asking for a raise so terrifying for people?
It's because money is such a taboo subject. It's a variety of reasons. But first of all, money is a taboo subject. And so we don't have a lot of experience of cutting our chops on even talking about it in easy situations. And so while you would have no problem asking your boss who they might think will win the Super Bowl, because you're used to having that kind of conversation with each other, having the money conversation is really awkward. And then you layer on top of it the fact that there's a power imbued in money in the workplace, in the sense that it's your worth, it's your identity, it's what someone, it's like asking, like, do you love me? How much do you love me? And so there's a lot that is wrapped into that question. And then the final piece is that there are some gender differences in the ways men and women are able to ask for raises and the responses that they get.
Tell me more about that, because this I find fascinating. It's fascinating stuff, and it plays out in so many different ways. One of them, of course, is the wage gap, that guys have a tendency, and we're stereotyping here, but to just sort of, I'm simplifying as well, to waltz in and ask for the raise, whereas a woman might be less likely to do that.
Yeah, so my friend Sally Krawcheck, who was the first female CFO of Citigroup, was the president of Smith Barney, was the president of Merrill Lynch Global Wealth Management, and is a huge advocate for closing the pay gap. She has said on over and over again that when she was in these very senior positions, at a ratio of 50-1, the male folks on her team would come in and ask for raises versus females. I mean, it's shocking. So research by Carnegie Mellon Professor Linda Babcock shows that it starts early. Men are four times more likely to negotiate their very first job offer ever. So even before they've had any work experience, they're already starting to ask for more. And so there are a variety of reasons behind that, which we can unpack. But the financial effect of women not asking for raises is that it compounds over our careers. And when you add into that, that most women on average spend about 12 years out of the paid workforce caring for elderly parents and or children, what it results in is women having half as much money for retirement as men. So it's a huge issue.
Yeah. And even if you isolated it to just that first job, and then both individuals had the cost of living increase through their career, the gap would be massive, even if that was the only time in which the difference. Yeah. So let's talk about what one should prepare before they walk into that office. This is not something that you just do on a whim. You need to do some thinking and some preparation. What does that include?
There's some preparation that is gender neutral, and I'll speak to that first. The gender neutral preparation is identifying what that position is paying in two places. First, externally at competitor firms, and second, what people are earning in that role to the extent that you can find out internally. The way you find out the external information is twofold. One, there are now various internet sites. Glassdoor is one of the most commonly cited salary comparison sites where you can get a sense of what that position is paying in different places. The second place you can go is to use your personal network and ask your close friends if they can introduce you to people that they know. So it's your we call that our loose network, who are in these positions. And you can ask them not, well, what are you making? But what have you found to be a reasonable salary range for this position with somebody with these academic credentials and this work experience? And so if you can get 3 to 5 of those conversations, and those data points, that really prepares you. And then the third is if you're super lucky and you work in an industry where maybe there have been detailed review studies done by industry organizations, for instance, in the financial services industry, particularly in the registered investment advisory world, there are a number of these studies, and you can get a sense. An advisor with 5 years experience earns this. One with 10 or 15 experience earns that. So those are the places on a general neuter basis that you would start.
What about business results or work results? What do you need to come prepared with so that you can build the business case? Other than just the phrase, I am so amazing, which is what I would say.
Well, I wanted to take a pause before I launched into the second piece of gender neutral data collection, and you have identified it perfectly. It is to make the ask needs to be based on your contributions to the firm's top and bottom line. At risk of stating the potentially obvious, it's not that you just feel you deserve more money. And so what you want to do is literally collect the data. And I encourage people to summarize it in writing, because oftentimes you're not going to get a yes or no on the raise. Well, 99.99% of the time, the answer to the raise is not going to come at the time of the ask. The person's going to say, let me think about it. So what you want them to think about is a nicely detailed one pager where you've outlined your specific contributions since your last salary review, or if it's appropriate, since you joined the firm, in terms of what you've added to the top and bottom line, particular projects that you showed initiative and took on your own, particular projects where you've collaborated very well with other team members in your firm or across various offices, are other things that are worth noting, even if they don't have direct bottom and top line impacts, because they show you're a team player.
Right.
So those are the three things that I suggest that you summarize.
What does the phrase sound like coming out of your mouth? Is it as simple as, I've done all this background, can I please have a raise? And should you include a percentage or a dollar value in the ask?
Well, now we get to the gender differences.
We've only got like 1 or 2 minutes left, so I'm torn.
Quickly, guys can say it any way they want. Literally, the research shows you can say, like, I want a raise, here's why. Women, we have to handle it differently. You start off with saying why you love working at the firm and how much you value them. Then the next thing you say is, here are some of the ways in which I have added value. I'm really excited to continue to keep adding value at this level. What would have to happen in order for me to earn a salary of X? Or does this body of work enable me to now earn a salary of X? You literally can't, as women, when we come in and say, I want more money, we get labeled the B word. And I hate that that's how we women have to negotiate. There is a firm called She Negotiates. You can Google it. And I recommend that every woman who wants to ask for a raise go take their low-cost online course to start understanding some of these nuances. Because, again, I'll just repeat it. The research shows men can ask anyway, and whether they get the raise or they are turned down, they are not penalized. If women don't ask in like a team-oriented kind of manner, we can get severely penalized for asking, even if we do get the raise. We're now branded, you know, she asked for too much. She's entitled. She's not a team player. She's tough to work with.
All this makes my blood boil, but I'm going to park that to the side for a second and ask you one last question, and that is, if the company says they can't afford to pay more, what's on the list of things that you could ask for that would be valuable to you? Is this the time when you say, I'd like 4 days a week, I'd like extra vacation, I'd like dot, dot, dot?
Exactly. When you can't get the money, you ask for other things that have significant value to you. So for women and men, flex time is one of the top things. So asking if you can work from home for a portion of your week, asking if you can work an abbreviated work schedule, if you can shift your hours to match your lifestyle needs, asking for more vacation, asking for more opportunities, business opportunities, asking for reimbursement of any educational programs you might want to take to advance your knowledge in your career are all great things to pull out of your pocket at this point.
Manisha, if I paid you anything, I would give you a raise today based on this entire conversation. Thank you for joining us.
Bruce, I want a 50% raise.
Of course. Let me think about it. As the boss, I can always do that. I'm not even remotely your boss. Manisha Dacour, thank you very much. Manisha came in to talk to us about asking for a raise, in particular, the relevance of accommodating the gender dynamic in those conversations. Follow me at Bruce Celery on Twitter, Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Celery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Welcome back. Moolah La, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit, as I said. The counseling is free and judgment free. Developing good habits can be a challenge in any category of life. It takes repetition, it takes some insight, and this is true for everything: healthy eating, you know, relationships, financial habits too. So how do you go about changing those habits to achieve financial success? Connor Richardson is a CPA and the author of Millennial Money Makeover, and he joins us now to talk about his five steps to rewire your brain for financial success. He joins us from Austin, Texas. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
When you say rewire your brain, I have visions of a Commodore 64 and some electrodes on my skin. You probably don't mean it quite that literally. What do you mean when you use that phrase?
Yeah, we don't need quite that much. What I mean by that is really just recircuiting some of your cues that you have throughout your day. So all habits really follow a simple pattern, which is a cue, a routine, and reward. And when we make good financial habits, or when we're trying to construct new ones, we're just replacing the cue with a new routine and a new reward to create good habits.
Mm. Give me an example of where you have applied this in your life when it comes to money.
Yeah, so I wrote Millennial Money Makeover back in 2019. And the reason I wrote the book was really for myself, and it just happened to apply to millions of other millennials. But the cue that I kept giving myself was I would see something that I wanted and not really have a budget or anything in mind to buy it. And I would swipe my credit card. That was my cue. My routine was to swipe it. And my reward was that I got the object immediately with no thought into whether I could afford it or not. And as a result of that, I got into some pretty dire financial situations and was able to turn that around. So instead of seeing a cue again with something I wanted to buy, instead of using the same routine, which was to swipe my credit card, I would start paying things in cash so that I knew that I could afford them. And of course, that cuts back on how many things you can actually afford. But my reward was that I started to get in good financial footing. And that completely changed my outlook on life and my trajectory in life.
Mm. How did you enable your brain to feel satisfied with a longer term reward versus the dopamine that your prior habit provided in the moment?
Well, it all starts with intention. So you have to make the decision to turn around your finances. Like in my case, for example, I made a very intentional decision to stop what I was doing and recircuit my brain. And this usually takes around 90 plus days to do. And the first 90 days can be grueling, but you kind of have to get through that initial exercise to where your brain, it actually rewires your neuroplasticity to end up giving yourself a good dopamine hit when the reward finally comes. And that dopamine actually increases once you pass your 90-day mark. And it's interesting because 3 months is a long time, but it's not a long time. And evolutionary, like biologically, it makes sense that it takes us this long to actually change our habits. Because, you know, you make decisions all the time that you think you're going to stick with for a week or two, and that's all it ends up being. But the decisions that you actually stick with, it actually changes the neurocircuitry in your brain.
Your five steps, I'm going to go through them here, but there are two that I want to focus on specifically. So decide what you want to change. Diagnose your habits. Write down your goal. Reverse engineer. Track your progress. The diagnosing of the habits. Is there like a menu here? What's on offer in terms of what you might determine to be a habit that you would like to change?
I think it all takes place in the sense of, you know, you have to decide where you want to go. So if you're trying to turn around your financial habits, for example, you have to make the decision to do that. And then what I lay out in Millennial Money Makeover is for people that know that they're in a bad financial situation, but they don't really know what to change. I give them the suggestion of take a look at the last maybe 2 or 3 months of your credit card bills or your spending and start to look at areas where you're buying things that you don't necessarily need, that you can begin to try to change some of the habits around purchasing those unnecessary items. And I literally suggest in the book that you take out a highlighter and a pen and you highlight everything and then tally them up so you can see how much you're spending on items that are non-essential. And when you see that number in the aggregate, it really starts to seep in. And that's really the power of writing down, you know, how much you're spending. And then you can write down your goals for how you're going to alleviate that. So the cues you can find in, you know, your bank statements, basically.
Yeah. If you're willing to open up the envelope and take a look or go online, write down your goal. I can see the power of that. It is empirical. It's specific. It's measurable. Let's use a simple example here. Someone's got $5,000 or $10,000 in credit card debt that they want to eliminate to zero. The next step is reverse engineer for success. Tell us about how you do that. So it's I want $10,000 to zero, and I want to do it in 12 months, say.
Yeah. So you take the $10,000 and you divide it by 12, and that's going to give you your monthly number that you need to, one, eliminate from your life. So you have to cut spending, or two, add income to try to pay that off quickly. And you can go either way. A lot of people focus on trying to earn more income with a side hustle or another alternative stream of income. But really the easiest way to do it is by cutting your variable expenses in life. So that's, you know, not purchasing new clothes, cutting back on going out to eat, all those non-essentials, you can cut down fairly quickly. Mm.
What are some of the pitfalls? I mean, in theory, this reads beautifully, and I'm sure you've got many, many examples and anecdotes of people who have been a home run, who've had a home run with this approach. Not everyone would, and there may be some common pitfalls that people stumble on or hurdles that stumble on. What would those be?
I think the most common pitfall is that people aim too small. So they make their goals small enough to where it's comfortable. And what people really need to know is set big, audacious goals for themselves so that if they do come up a little bit short, when they look back, they're actually changing their financial life completely, whether that's paying off credit card debt or trying to save. You always end up ahead in the long run if you're setting big goals for yourself. So dream big.
Unless they are in the movie Castaway for the first half when Tom Hanks is by himself on a desert island. No one lives entirely alone. There are other humans, and those other humans can provide cues or hurdles that slow or interrupt the progress. How do you weave in the dynamic of the reality that we are humans with spouses and kids and parents and coworkers and friends, et cetera?
Well, when I started my financial journey, I was dating the girl that is now my wife. And, you know, you have to get your partner on board. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that takes a couple months to do. Sometimes it can take longer. But if you can directionally change which way you're headed and gamify what you're doing, that's really where I've seen the most success. So you have to make it fun. You have to make it entertaining. And you also have to not forget to reward yourself. Everyone loves the dopamine hit, but when you pay off maybe 1 or 2 months of credit card debt, you know, go out and reward yourself because you definitely want the reward piece of the habit loop hitting you on a regular basis to make sure you can sustain your trajectory.
What's your example? What is your very particular and unique to you reward?
Mine's having a nice bottle of wine or champagne.
Nice so being whenever, like $30 or nice being $300?
Probably about $100.
$100. I don't really drink very much. So $100 just is like, I mean, I pay that for a Broadway musical, but wine? Oh my gosh. My role is not to judge. Hooray for you and rewarding your progress. And hooray for you for joining us today, Connor. We really appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Connor Richardson is a CPA. He is author of Millennial Money Makeover. And he was here to talk about his 5 steps to rewiring your brain for financial success. He was in Austin, Texas today.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Coming up later, I'll speak to registered nurse Cassandra Mello about her TikToks, her TikTok videos, where she shares her personal finance tips and tricks, often in scrubs, just so you know. But first, Dr. Moira Summers is here to share how young Canadians can make good financial habits stick. Here's a good habit. You could read our newsletter, and it's very easy. The cue is go to our website and type in your name, and then it just shows up in your mailbox. Moolala.ca is where you can sign up for that newsletter. And once a month, we will send you a link to the things that we have done here on Sirius XM, on CBC Radio, on CityLine, BNN Bloomberg, wherever we're out yakking about. And then you'll be all up to date.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
It can be a huge challenge for young Canadians to budget and save and live in this ridiculous world that we find ourselves in. Ridiculous, amazing, but also ridiculous. Dr. Moira Summers is a Canadian clinical neuropsychologist specializing in financial psychology. That is a very big and very impressive title. She joins me now to share her tips on how to make good financial habits stick. And she's in, Moira, you're in Manitoba today.
I am.
Hello from Manitoba. And welcome. Welcome back to the program. I want to start off with a question that I'm sure you get asked, but I think it's so important as context for this conversation, is describe the link between spending money and psychology. At its root, how do those two things come together?
Oh, mercy. You know, there's just so many different levels. You can't survive without spending money these days, right? Like no matter how much of a survivalist you are, at some point, you're going to have to get your hands on some goods, and that generally requires money. My interest as a financial psychologist, Bruce, is all about the factors that lead people to be conscious or unconscious about that spending, to spend wisely or to spend in accordance with what they really value, not only for their present self, but for their future well-being, you know, the granny and grandpa version of them. And then, of course, what are the factors that interfere with the good decisions?
Now, this is a challenge that is different for younger Canadians, however we define younger Canadians, than it is for, you know, baby boomers who are just at a different life stage. The circumstances of being young in Canada in these times are very, very different. What would be some examples of that difference in your mind?
Well, for the first time in many, many years, we're dealing with significant inflation, for example. And just what you, if you had thought to put together a budget and it was a pretty tight one, you will be noticing that it's harder and harder to make things fit into your predetermined category at the level that you want to. So there are just things that are happening that are outside of our control in domains that we haven't had to deal with in a long time. Housing costs, food costs, all of those.
Yeah. I have a 12-year-old in the house, and it's so interesting to observe the kinds of behaviors, some connected to money, some not, in which their life has become gamified. And a part of that is amazing and so fantastic. And then there are also times when they'll come to me and they'll talk about, I'm earning cryptocurrency by playing this game. And I'm like, no, this isn't how this is supposed to work. How do you look at the reward-oriented environment that we are in? And whether it's playing games or earning points on a card or earning crypto on an app, all those things, how does that connect to good and not so good financial behavior?
Let's start with the bad. I mean, some of it is just so divorced from reality. The TikTok hucksters who, you know, promise that you will be rich, and in fact that you're stupid if you don't follow up with this crypto thing, and just having people who are not acting in their best interests, and those people are coming into our house every day via the telephone or via the game. I would love that, you know, gamification be used for good in terms of making it easier for people to track their spending and to earn rewards, and for financial consciousness to be more fun than it is now, which is often a drag. But there are some things that are happening. For example, one of the things I wanted to talk to you about today was a new product on the market through PC Financial, which is making it easy for people to earn points on
the PC Money account
card, where they don't have to use credit to earn points. When I was working with people who were financially struggling, I would often see their dilemma, where they would want to use their own money to feel more in control of their spending, but they would feel this sense of loss, you know, with FOMO, because they couldn't get points by paying with cash. And now that little dilemma has been solved because there are new products out there.
One of the dynamics that we hear about is people behaving in ways that aren't in their self-interest because of what they see at the shelf or on their app. And we, like, it's 2x points day. And so you end up buying bathroom tissue at full price instead of waiting for it to be on sale because it's 2x points day. What are the tricks from a psychology standpoint that we can use to hack our brain to spend in ways that are consistent with Grandpa Bruce, who will be dashing, by the way, versus spending habits that will not be so good for Grandpa Bruce?
Or even for current version of Bruce, right? Because for most of us, there is a, at some point, you will have to rob Peter to pay Paul if you're not paying attention to that. So future self or current self, using your own money is probably the biggest hack there is out there.
Which is using cash or debit such that it comes out of your account immediately, and there isn't a risk that you're going to have an outstanding balance on your credit card. Is that what you mean?
That's right. There's this interesting thing that happens even when you imagine a method of payment, that if the method of payment that you're contemplating using involves your own money, then it seems that there's a little bit more pain associated with paying, and people will be more inclined to put stuff back on the shelf. And so any method that involves using your own money is one way of being more in control of your spending and less at the mercy of very sophisticated marketers, wherever, however they're coming at us.
If I ruled the world, I'd do so many things, but I would remove plastic of any kind, credit card, debit card, or whatever, until a young human was 25. And I would do that because of the evidence that we see around the pain of spending when you're peeling off the bills, right? Is there, in your view of the data, a difference between the pain associated with a debit and the pain associated with credit? Is it worse when you tap with a debit card? Does it feel more like cash?
People report that it feels more like cash. And, you know, Bruce, I think that we need to say there's a role for credit and there's a role for debit and there's a role for this new product, which is in many ways better than debit, that the PC folks have put out. You know, there's a fundamental safety issue involved in carrying around a schwack of cash. I've had patients who've lived in very bad neighborhoods and who didn't have access to cards before. And that was not a happy situation. That wasn't a safe situation. And so cards that allow you to pay using your own money increase your sense of control. They also increase your awareness and your prudence, it seems, as well as your safety.
And, you know, it will soon come where we will not be able to spend that paper cash anymore. Like Sweden, they're going to be, yes. You know, they could well be cashless in the next year or two. Yeah. And in Canada could be soon, right? Mm-hmm. Let me close with this. If you were to give one tip to a young Canadian listening to our conversation, or a grown-up Canadian who happens to have a young Canadian in their life, a kid or a nephew or a niece or something, someone they're mentoring, what would be the biggest thing that you would say in order to help set them on the right track when it comes to money?
One is just try and stay conscious and find easy ways to make that happen. So there are this everyday spending account that's come out provides you with a summary at the end of the month about where the money has gone. And you need to look at that. You need to turn around and look at that. You need to look for banking opportunities that meet the needs of young people, Bruce. You know, as soon as you turn 18, banks consider you to be traditional banks consider you to be an adult, and they often put ridiculous transaction fees onto the accounts and require ridiculous levels of minimums that people can't put. But they will often, you know, very kindly give you overdraft protection. And so you want to choose an account that really has no transaction fees, no monthly minimums, that allows you to earn points, that allows you to be conscious in ways that are much less effortful.
That's great. Much less effortful. I don't know that that's a phrase, but I'm going to give you a pass. I'm teasing. Moira, thank you for joining us today. Dr. Moira Summers is going to Google effortful and see if she is allowed to say it. She's a PhD and I am not. She is a Canadian clinical neuropsychologist specializing in financial psychology. She joined us from Manitoba today to talk about many things, but among them, Canadians, young Canadians in particular, and how to build solid financial habits. Stay with us. Coming up next, registered nurse Cassandra Mello is here to talk about her TikTok channel or profile or whatever it is. She shares all sorts of personal finance tips, often in her scrubs, standing in front of a gas pump. Really interesting to see how that platform is used to engage young people, and I guess old people too, on financial decisions. If you have feedback for us on today's show, it could be thoughts, comments, questions, ideas. Be effortful and email us ask@moolala.ca. Moolala is sponsored by Home Equity Bank, the provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. Here's the big idea. It empowers Canadian homeowners age 55 plus to live retirement on their terms by providing them with a safe and easy way to access the equity built up in their home. And given the prices of houses these days, that equity can be considerable. The funds can be used for whatever the client wants or whatever the client needs. And that could be travel, it could be helping grandchildren, or it could be supplementing their day-to-day expenses. You can access up to 55% of your home's value with no monthly mortgage payments required. Go to chip.ca to learn how you can stay in the home you love without having to move or downsize. That's Home Equity Bank.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We talk to a lot of personal finance bloggers and YouTubers and tweeters and all that sort of thing on this show. But increasingly, the platform of choice is TikTok. My next guest decided to share her passion for personal finance on TikTok, the platform that anyone under the age of 19 has on their phone, including my 12-year-old. Cassandra Mello is a registered nurse. She has 115,000 followers on her platform and over 2 million likes. She joins us now to talk about her TikTok journey and what you can expect when you tune in. She's in Vaughan, Ontario. Hello there, Cassandra.
Hi, Bruce. Thank you so much for having me.
What made you so passionate about personal finance?
You know what? This is really interesting because if you asked me, my 18-year-old self, if I would be making videos about money or personal finance, I would not have believed you because I had really such a negative money mindset. I thought that kind of money was evil. I thought that if you wanted money, that made you a bad person. So I had a really, really unproductive money mindset for a while. However, I started nursing and then about a year into my nursing journey actually working as a nurse, transitioning from student to working, I just kind of felt that, at that point, right when I had started working as a nurse, I then started getting financially literate. Just by chance, my younger brother, who was in high school at the time, actually brought like the Rich Dad, Poor Dad personal finance book. Mm. And I read that and oh my God, that was like the gateway into personal finance for me. And then I just started learning about investing. And then here I am 3 years later making personal finance content. And I have a pretty solid portfolio personally as well. So really interesting.
As you describe it, I can't help but thinking it's like you've stolen the keys to the meds cupboard in the emergency room or something. It's like, oh my gosh, I've now got access to all this amazing stuff, man. So you had the passion, whatever your gateway drug was, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, hooray for you. What led you to decide to be public about it? Like, why did you and was TikTok first, or were you a YouTuber that became a TikToker?
Yeah, so TikTok was first. And, initially, like I mentioned just a second ago, transitioning to student nurse to working as a nurse, it was really hard. And I think a lot of nursing students or new nurses would know that the first year is like hell. And so I was in the middle of this really challenging year professionally at work. Just the transition was very difficult for me. And then also creatively, I felt that my job as a nurse wasn't really giving me a creative outlet. And so that kind of wasn't feeding some part of my life that I felt that was missing. So that kind of creative aspect, I would say. Mm. And so then I just thought to myself, oh, maybe I should make TikToks. Like that would be cool to create videos and kind of be lighthearted about it. I actually started creating nursing content first, but I quickly realized that, I think I kind of want a little escape from nursing. And yeah. So then I thought to myself, what else do I kind of know about or have a unique perspective on? And then that was personal finance. I started investing about a year ago and then I kind of thought, oh, maybe people would actually benefit from learning about this information that, like you said, I feel like I have this key to knowledge, this newfound knowledge.
Yeah.
And I think that other people should learn about it too. And that's how I kind of started.
Well, and you're unabashed about your nursing background in that you're often in scrubs. When are you recording these videos?
Yeah. So sometimes it's on a drive back from work or before I go into work. It's never at work because I'm just so busy at work. And then, when I have some downtime on my days off for the weekends, then I would also record as well. So it's a mix of whenever I have kind of time.
There is a song in one of your videos and the lyric goes, my money doesn't jiggle, jiggle. It Folds, which my 12-year-old listens to. It's a very catchy tune. How do you go about it? Because what some people might not know about TikTok is very often there is an underlying song that is completely, in that way, it's tangentially related to your content, but it's more that it's a popular song. It's a trending song. How do you go about making these videos, choosing the song that goes underneath, choosing the topic?
Yeah, so on TikTok, it's very interesting because it's very sound-based or musically-based. And so sometimes, you know, I've used audios in the past that were trending audios, but, you know, I've learned that it doesn't have to be necessarily related to your topic. Like the Jingle Jingle one was related to money in a loose kind of funny way. But sometimes TikTok is so abstract sometimes that you can just kind of have a song or have a sound and make it your own and make it relevant based on the videos or effects that you show. And so it's kind of just having a little bit of creativity and trying to make something your own and make it relevant to your niche, which is really interesting. And that's what I really like about TikTok is that you can have something that's totally unrelated and somehow make a connection in your content.
One of the things that's so compelling is it's you. Like you're just there, you're talking into your phone headset, you're driving to and from work. It is a very different user experience than something, say, on Instagram, where it's like perfect and photoshopped and filtered and all that stuff. Was that one of the reasons why you decided to focus on TikTok instead of Instagram stories or something like that, where the production values and the aesthetic just feels more amped up or contrived?
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, Bruce, because I, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of Instagram because I like being real. I like seeing other people's vulnerabilities, and Instagram, like you kind of touched on, is so curated. Mm-hmm. And it's even, you know, it's even more business or brand centered now, which is fine, but I feel like it's missing that kind of personal touch. And I feel like that's why a lot of people flock to TikTok, because they want to see realness. They want to see people in their natural element. They don't want to see kind of a curated feed of what their life is, of like their highlight reel. So TikTok is to me a lot more real. And I feel like I personally resonate with that too. You know, even on my personal Instagram account, I rarely post them, even on my personal. And when I do, I really don't care about filters or anything like that. So to me, TikTok just seemed a lot more authentic and aligned with my values. So that's why.
Your most viewed video, as I understand it, is about things you refuse to spend your money on as a 25-year-old who's saving and investing a good portion of your income. What are some of those things?
Yeah, so I think I talked about some sparkling water and Fiji water, which got some people, which is very controversial, apparently. And, you know, that's just who I am. Like, I just happen to not like expensive things. If I was born that way, or maybe because my parents were kind of frugal and I was raised that way, but you know, expensive restaurants, Fiji water, kind of like the frills. I really don't care about those materialistic things or expensive things. And I'm kind of just more like a no frills kind of girl. So yeah.
It received something like 1 million views or something like that. How did you find out that the views went through the roof like that? I hope you weren't driving when you looked at your phone and were like, I got what I did.
I know. You know, unfortunately, I pulled my phone when driving, which is great. Don't recommend that, but yeah, it was interesting. It kind of blew up right away. Sometimes like with TikTok, you know, within the first 3 or 4 hours, if something's going to blow up. And so I got a lot of views and notifications initially in those first couple hours. And then it was kind of like, so it blew up a lot for a couple days, and then it kind of stopped, and then it kind of picked up again. So it's really interesting. It was kind of like a fast burn at first, and then it was kind of like a slower burn. So it's really interesting to see how videos blow up on TikTok.
Now, you have a job. You work as a nurse in long-term care principally, and all the power to you in these times. Hooray for your work there. There are TikTokers, though, who have this be a real and substantial income stream. Is that of interest for you?
Honestly, it is. And, you know, I feel like nursing is such a great career, but it's so draining physically and mentally and emotionally sometimes. And, you know, I don't know if I can see myself doing this career for 40 plus years, for 30 plus years. And so I really have thought about monetization and, you know, if I can help people in a different way, you know, not in a healthcare kind of way, but now in a personal finance way. And so I definitely have thought about it. I'm currently in the process of brainstorming or navigating how I can make that a reality. So it's definitely in my mind for sure.
If you were to focus on just one thing, if there was one TikTok topic that you would really want people to watch and internalize, what would it be?
So my content currently focuses predominantly on investing. And I think people need to learn about investing. And, you know, with regard to the stock market, people may get so intimidated and think that it's only for business majors or people on Wall Street or for Toronto Bay Street. And I just want people to know that that's not the case at all. You know, learning about the something like the stock market and investing is actually more accessible to you than you think. And it's actually much less scary and intimidating. So I really want people to know that they can learn something new. You know, I was a nurse. I studied biology and chemistry in high school. I never touched a business class ever, but I was able to learn personal finance and learn some business principles and investing. And so I really wish people would learn more about investing for sure.
Your TikTok handle is?
Money with Cass.
Money with Cass. Cassandra, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Bruce.
Cassandra Mello is a registered nurse, but in this conversation, she is a TikToker with 115,000 followers and growing and over 2 million likes. That is our show for today. I really need to get on TikTok. A big thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country, and Home Equity Bank, provider of the CHIP reverse mortgage. To enable you to stay up to date on all things Moolala, our newsletter can be signed up for. Is that a thing? You can sign up for our newsletter. That's a better way to say it, at moolala.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast version of the SiriusXM broadcast on any of the podcast platforms. While you're there, leave us a review. How great would that be? I am also the money columnist for CityLine. So you can go to cityline.tv and search for some of the stuff that I have done over there. On social, at Bruce Sellery on Twitter. That's S-E-L-L-E-R-Y. Bruce Sellery, Moolala on Facebook. Thank you so much for joining us and have a great day.